Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Jim, you're a sea captain, right?
That's true, Patrick. I often wear the captain's hat and take the wheel.
Well, I was wondering about something. What was the most important thing you learned out there on the waters?
Well, I've learned many things, Patrick, but one stands out above the rest. Always heed the boatman's call. Okay, Patrick, it is time we open up the international line
and yes.
Check in with our dear friend and listener in Scotland, Stephen Rutledge, for a patron episode. This is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us is...
Stephen Rutledge, calling in from Scotland.
Hey, Stephen, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks, guys. It's good to see you and speak to you.
So we were talking a little bit before we started recording. So first off, you're drinking a gigantic beer.
it's only a half liter, so
okay. It just looks big on the screen.
Big can, yeah. It's a tall glass. That's it.
So I want to ask you to critique this for me from a British point of view. Iced coffee. Do you guys drink iced coffee over there, or is that an American thing?
Maybe strange people do. I don't drink coffee at all.
Okay.
I know in the coffee shops, you can get all these weird things that some of them have got ice and stuff in them, I guess, but. Yeah, because I'm not a coffee drinker, and my wife only drinks plain black coffee, so my exposure to it is quite narrow.
Okay.
So, sorry, I couldn't pass genuine comment on that, but I'm sure some people do, but I certainly wouldn't.
Fair enough. Okay. Now, we're going to talk about a particular year in music that you want to discuss. Before we do that, let me just quickly say that to the listeners, we had a whole conversation about this off air, but... Stephen has become quite the NFL fan in recent years. When did you start to follow the NFL?
Probably about 5 years ago. Then I started following the Browns during the 1-15 season and then into the 0-16 season. So since then. So I did get on board before they got good, which is nice.
It's so endearing to me that not only are you just sort of a recent convert to the to American football in the NFL, but that you adopted my team.
Amazing.
My home state team, the Cleveland Browns. That's great. You know, I think you said before you picked them because they were such a, sad sack franchise, and yet you've been able to ride this wave. It's amazing.
Exactly, yeah. Well, it was funny because when I was looking to choose a team, I had the luxury of having West Ham is my football team in England, because that's the team that my dad and my great-grandfather supported. So you don't have a choice. Well, right. I mean, I suppose you do, but not really if you've been honest about it. You don't have a choice. It was passed down. So I had no ties to any American football team. And I was looking at it, I thought, well, if it's geographic closeness, would that be the Patriots? So that was never going to happen.
Right.
So, and then I thought, well, the only other connection I got to any team is I've got a friend who works at Amazon, and he occasionally goes out to Seattle. So I did toy with the idea. Initially, I thought I was leaning towards the Seahawks, but the problem is, I think it was the year after they just lost the Patriots in the Malcolm Butler game. So in my heart, it didn't feel right joining a team that's already good.
Right.
I thought, and then once I started reading a bit about the game and the history of the Browns and stuff like that, and then I got into the Around NFL podcast, and one of the guys, Mark Seth, was a huge Browns fan. He's also not from Cleveland. He was from New York, I think, and he adopted the Browns when Boney Kozar was the QB. And so all those things sort of came together, and I just thought, no, this is my team. I'm going to choose them, and so I did.
That's exciting.
Very cool.
Did you know anything about Cleveland before becoming a Browns fan?
Well, I knew Hello Cleveland, as in the the joke for the musicians would say, I think it was from Clapton originally, wasn't it? But and I knew geographically where it was, but not much else apart from that. Maybe hopefully one day I'll get to go and see a game at the stadium there. But I have seen the Browns in the UK, so when they played in London, I did get to go to that game, so that was good.
That's cool. And of course, Cleveland, Patrick, it's now the home of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum, but and the reason for that, because it was the home of Alan Freed, the famous disc jockey.
Yeah.
I never realized why it was there. So that explains it.
He supposedly coined the term rock and roll, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Stephen, what is the topic you want to discuss today?
Well, you've had a few other patrons on who've talked about different years in music, making their case as to why that was the best year in in music, sort of history for albums and music that was put out. And I thought, well, when the last time I was on, we talked about Manson, and Jim had mentioned about it made him maybe a little bit foggy in the sort of mid to late 90s because of family circumstance was impinging on his music consumption habits at the time. And I thought, well, given that for me, sort of the prime meridian of music is 1997, in my opinion, it's the best year in music, I thought I should try and make my case.
Okay.
And try and back it up rather than just say it. I need to, and then try and, you know, talk about some key albums that I think came out that year. And use that as my, here we go, this is why 97 is the best.
Okay, so where would you like to start?
Okay, well, I mentioned to you, Jim, about four particular albums I wanted to talk about. But before I did that, I just wanted to mention that there's three very significant albums that came out this year, for me personally, that that people who know me might be surprised that aren't going to be in this list of four. Now, one of them we already talked about, which is last time, Attack of the Grey Lantern by Manson. Mm-hmm. So that came out in 97. Teenage Fan Club Songs from Northern Britain came out in 1997, but that's a whole episode on its own for me. There's too much there. So, and also The Sound of Lies by the Jayhawks, which is another personal favourite of mine. Again, I couldn't do that justice in a quick, briefer summary. So those are added to the tally. That's like your starting point, all right? But we're still going to add more to that. So just those three on their own is pretty good. But we've got more to come.
Okay.
Yeah, so the first one I wanted to talk about is Blur's eponymous album from that year, which I guess most listeners, and I'm certainly guessing most stateside music fans will be aware of, and non-music fans because of Song 2, which features on there, which was used a lot for sports, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I personally think this is by far their best album out of everything they put out for a number of different reasons. But I'm also curious as to whether... how well you guys know that album, or is it basically just Song 2 and that's it? Because I guess a lot of people may have dismissed the album because of that. And thought, hang on, what? No, this is just another, you know, kind of loud, quiet.
Yeah.
Well, I'll say something before I let Patrick answer here, but I'll just say, I think the majority of Americans know the song 2, but don't even know Blur.
Right.
Okay. You know what I'm saying? Right. In terms of mainstream acknowledgement, right? Mm-hmm. It's one of those songs that, like you said, it's become kind of so well known in like sports settings and other uses, probably movie trailers, commercials, things that it's bigger than the band, at least in the United States. But what's your impression of this album, Patrick?
Well, I'll tell you, I bought the album because of the song. When I heard the song, I'm like, I got to check this album out. I didn't really know much about them, although my buddy Bish was a big fan of them even earlier. But I got to tell you, it's a fantastic record from top to bottom. And this just totally got me into Blur, and it got me into understanding the sort of, you know, battle within the Britpop, you know, scene, which is from us across the ocean looking at it. It probably took on a different tone, as, you know, much different in the UK with all the music magazines still, you know, publishing in the late 90s. And kind of this is the album for me that got me into being a fan of Blur, and then, you know, kind of sent me backwards to all the other stuff, you know, that happened before. Man, it's just been probably my favorite, you know, Britpop band since then. So,
sure. So were you familiar with Jim, or was it fairly?
I
not sort of.
I think probably like Patrick. I think this is where I got more into Blur. I knew Blur, you know, a little bit before this, but you know, we were so inundated with Oasis in terms of the Britpop thing over here, and it was sort of like, I wasn't even really aware of that whole Blur versus Oasis kind of thing in the United States until later on, but probably after this album when they started to really gain some traction over here. And then I started to be like, well, to me, I know which way I lean on this, but I'll save that for another time. But anyway, I find the Blur catalog overall to be much more satisfying than the Oasis catalog. So
it's not even close how much better Blur are than Oasis. Okay. I didn't sell as many records.
I'm among friends here.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, you'll get no argument from me. Oasis is obviously a much more easier sell in America because it's much more straightforward.
Yeah.
When Blur, and I mean, this album takes on a lot of American sort of alternative rock influences, you know, like Sonic Youth, Dinosaur Jr., Pavement. You can hear all that coming through. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are, much like the Kinks or the Beatles, they are a very English band. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not even British. They are very much an English band. Mm. And, you know, that Ray Davies sort of influence is really strong. The musical kind of influence that came through in the Beatles as well is also very strong in their writing. But they also wrote really great tunes, and there's just so many good songs on this record.
Yeah, I know it.
And it starts off with an absolute masterpiece.
Love it.
And you're like,
yeah.
There's a lot in terms of the situation with Oasis. I mean, they'd lost the race of Oasis in sales massively. Oasis were by far the biggest band in Britain at this time after What's the Story, Morning Glory. But what I found fascinating was that whereas Oasis just kept retreading the same thing to getting less and less returns, and when you're only basically recycling other people's ideas, eventually you're gonna run out of ideas quite quickly. And I'm sure it was either Melody Maker or Enemy. I'm sure I remember reading the review of this when it came out, and talking about that lead track, Beetle Bum, which, again, if any listeners aren't familiar with it, definitely check out that for opening song, because it's a masterpiece. But I think the review was something like, whilst Oasis may have won the sales war, it must gall Noel Gallagher, having spent all his life wanting to be like John Lennon, to hear this song, Beetle Bum, and realise that Blur can just do it better.
Right.
Because it's not slavish. It's not it's not a pastiche of the Beatles.
Right.
It's this is what the Beatles might have done now if they were in their early 20s to mid-20s now. You know, to listeners, if all you know is song two, forget about that. Check out the rest of the album. And if you don't want to check out the rest of the album, just check out the first track, Beetle Bum, because it is so good. And when she lets me slip away, she tells me.
I've always loved about Damon Albarn is every time I hear his work or a new song from any of his projects, whether it's Blur or Gorillaz or whatever, it sounds like he's trying to do something new. You know, you'll hear some things that seem familiar. You can see where the influences are, but it never feels like you said, it never feels like a retread. It always feels like he's trying to put something in there that you haven't heard before. And that's what I really respect
and
about his work.
I think the fact they took on sort of Graham Coxon, the guitar players, his love of alternative rock and that sort of Dinosaur Jr., Sonic Youth kind of stuff, much more in this. It was less poppy. It's got great tunes on it, but they're not playing the pop hits game anymore, which they played possibly too much on the previous album. And things like the Bowie as well still comes through. That's really another strong influence, I think. It's married them so well together. So you just had that perfect blend of sort of American alternative rock and English pop. And it's just this wonderful amalgam of just beautiful noise. But even going back and listening to song two, if you listen to it on a decent set of headphones, in decent quality, the guitar is disgusting. It's filthy.
Yeah.
It's actually awful. Yeah, I mean, in a good way, in the best possible way. It is a nasty, nasty sound. I can understand why it appealed to you, Patrick, when you heard that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, another thing, you know, just looking this back over and thinking about it, I mean, I loved that they kind of like REM, it was all four members were credited with creating the music. It wasn't like all songs written by Damon Albarn or, you know, this one by Graham Coxon or whatever. And that was always cool to me. It was like, wow, this is cool. Like, you know, that's the way REM did it. And that's the way I think most songs really are created when you're in a band. So I always loved that about them too. And I think maybe this is a whole other episode, but I think it's really interesting when a band decides to make an eponymous album sort of mid-career.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's
I think that's kind of fascinating.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it kind of is. And a show of like real confidence, I think, in what they've created in some ways. At least that's what I interpret that here, but that might be a fun episode sometime too.
So real quickly, this album did go to number one in the UK.
It did. In fact, it was knocked off of number one by Attack of the Grey Lantern by Manson.
Is that right?
Okay.
Wow, nice. I didn't know that.
So it came out, I think it came out early in the year, but yes, it went to number one, yeah.
It did. Cool. Now, in the US, it went to number 61. However, it was eventually certified gold. So it did decent sales in the US.
Yeah, but it would have sold significantly more than that in the UK, I would imagine. So
yeah,
even though Oasis was a bigger band, Britpop was starting to wind down, but it was still a huge, the bands that were huge were still huge. They hadn't sort of tailed off at that point. Yeah, they were still festival headliners and all this sort of thing. So
Okay, what's next?
Okay, so next up, we're staying in the Britpop arena, kind of. We're talking about Urban Hymns by The Verve. Mm. Now, again, much like the previous album, this is dominated by one massive monster hit that almost everyone will know, and which also may have put them off listening to the rest of the album. So obviously Bittersweet Symphony is the lead track, and there's one that everyone will imagine will know. Probably my least favourite track on the album, probably due to overfamiliarity, because you first heard it and you thought, that's a massive hit. That's going to be massive. Yeah. And it was massive. Mm-hmm. but all, the real good stuff on the album is what comes after. So again, I guess it's a question of how familiar were you guys with the rest of this album and the band at all, you know? So
not me much I'll at all. This. I know the song Lucky Man. I think that was also a single.
That was a single.
And
that
as soon
single,
as I just, I'm looking at the track list now and I saw that and I could immediately hear it in my head. So I did hear that enough for it to stick all these years later. But I never really took to Bittersweet Symphony. And then biggest thing I know about that song was the controversy over the songwriting credit with the Rolling Stones. But I never really took to that song, so I didn't really explore this album or this band much. What about you, Patrick?
I'll tell you, I kind of got into them after this album came out, and it was kind of a weird thing, and I remember this pretty clearly. So the song The Drugs Don't Work is, I think, the fourth or fifth song on this record. I know it's on side one, but one of my writing influences, and actually a guy who's appeared on this podcast, Mark Jenkins, you guys go way, way back and find the week we did on the first Velvet Underground album. Mark was with us then. But I remember he had written a review in the Washington Post or the Washington City Paper, one of the two places we both used to write. His opening line was, "The drugs do work, apparently." And I was like, later I saw him, I said, "What was that? Like that reference? Like, I don't even get that." And he was like, "Oh, it's a Verve song. You don't know that album?" And I'm like, "No." He goes, "Well, you really should listen to it. It's pretty darn good."
Yes.
And then I went back and got into that. And then later, I was able to see and review a show from Richard Ashcroft. So that was pretty cool when he was doing his solo stuff. So yeah, I got into it, gosh, probably 3 or 4 years after it came out, but loved it. I mean, it's a really rich kind of album that weaves in a lot of rock and roll history, at least to my ears. Yeah. And it's been a while since I've gone back and given it a full spin on the headphones, but it's always like a tapestry kind of work to me.
Yeah, what I would say to you, Jim, and to any other listeners who, again, not just Bittersweet Symphony didn't do it for them, just start with track two. And yeah. You're still going to hear an absolutely amazing album.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, The Drugs Don't Work is like the centerpiece masterpiece song on there. I think I mentioned this when I played it on The Hoop, but yeah, that was a number one single in the UK.
Yeah.
Which demonstrates the difference between our charts and yours that, a song called The Drugs Don't Work gets the number one. But that's, again, it's not just those two songs. You got a song like Sonnet is just fantastic. I mean, that's probably after The Drugs Don't Work, it's the next best one on there, but you got real rockers like Rolling People. You got expansive, sort of groovy kind of jams like Velvet Morning and Butterfly. You know, it's fans of classic rock. And obviously, this album is 23 years old now, nearly 24 years old now. It's still such classic rock on its own.
Yeah.
But fans of what you and I would call classic rock would find much to enjoy. Particularly, I think fans of The Doors, there's a lot of that kind of spacey kind of influence on it.
My friend and me. Looking through her red box of memories, faded, I'm sure, but love seems to stick in her veins, you know. Yes, there's love if you want it. Don't sound like no sonnet.
And the guitar work of Nick McCabe on there is very understated, but he was kind of key to the band. You know, they'd split up after the previous album, Northern Soul, which, again, I don't know if you're familiar with the song History. If you're not, you need to check that song out. That's another just epic, a superb song. But they split up and then came back together. So Ashcroft had written most of these songs and then the band got back together. And when they split up again, all his solo stuff just wasn't quite the same because it's that little magic secret sauce that with them working together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just because one guy wrote most of the songs, like you said, it's just that even if they don't get on personally, they can work together brilliantly and just Jail Will Make Magic, and it's got a real sort of swagger and looseness and a sort of groove to it, you know, the whole album. And again, it was an absolute monster, massive hit over here, number one album, turned them into, again, festival headliners and the like. It was just absolutely everywhere.
I think that that's a great way to put it, too, is kind of that looseness. It almost has like an effortlessness to it, some of these songs. They just kind of glide along. You know, it's like the internal propulsion is so strong that it's almost like it's effortless for these songs to go on. Like, yeah, that's a really good way to put it, yeah.
It's almost got a little bit of that sort of jam band stuff.
Yeah.
Just a hint of it. It's not like that, but it's because it's got too much pop tightness to it as well. I was thinking that, you know, Rob Gates might enjoy this because, you know, it's because of the Doors influence. And if Scott Parks isn't familiar with this album, then he needs to get over there immediately because.
Absolutely.
I think it'll be right up his street.
Yeah, but, totally. Yeah,
another sort of huge monster hit over here, packed full of amazing, amazing songs. Yeah, if you asked any people of my age, one of the best songs of the 90s, Neil would say, probably either Drugs Don't Work or Bittersweet Symphony, they would be in the like the top 50 best songs of the decade.
Wow.
You know, and they're both on the same album.
Right. Same side, first side, yeah.
All right, I'll give it a go.
So, yeah, so if you don't like Bittersweet Symphony, just start with track 2.
Yeah.
There's still loads of stuff to enjoy there. You know, it's a really good album.
Okay.
Really, really good. Well, slight change of tack next, and an artist that will probably be familiar to a lot of listeners is Nick Cave. And The Bad Seeds, what I think is his best album, which is saying something, because
yeah,
the
is.
Man has produced a consistently good and high quality body of work, but this is just on the pinnacle. This is him at his absolute finest.
Wow.
It's much more stripped down, and I mean, we're well out of the Britpop zone now. We're fully into a very downbeat and intense sort of spiritual almost record. A lot of the songs are almost hymn-like, but man. And there's almost no guitar in it either. It's mainly just piano and voice and a little bit of light instrumentation. There's a few exceptions, but it's mainly just piano and voice. But man, when the songs are that good and the voice is that good, you don't need anything else. Yeah, I mean, there's so many killer songs on this album. I mean, you got Brompton Oratory, you got Are You the One I've Been Waiting For, People Ain't No Good, Into My Arms. I mean, it's almost overwhelming how good the songs are on here. And his writing style has changed over the years, and he doesn't really write in this same sort of style anymore.
Right.
But it's downbeat, and you know, people say this is depressing music, but I don't find it depressing. I find it uplifting.
Mm.
It's sad music, but the sad music doesn't have to make you feel sad, you know?
Yeah.
And I've mentioned this before to one of the people. There's a real spirituality to his work that runs through it and has done all the way through. Yeah, and he embraces all aspects of his personality, the light, the dark, everything. It comes through in here, and yeah, I said it's like almost some of these songs are almost hymn-like. That kind of relates to the experience you get when you see him live. Just make sure you're in the right mood for it, because yeah, some people may not, you know.
And that's exactly it. And that's why one thing with Nick Cave, in terms of listening to his albums, is I have to be in the exact right mood. You know what I mean? It's like when I want to listen to it, and I'm in that mood, I want to listen to it, it's fantastic, like you said, but it's not the kind of thing I can just sort of put on anytime.
Well, they're not all, they're not all as dark and sort of, sort of downbeat as this. I mean, yes, I'm a big fan of the sort of double album when he did Live Orpheus and Abattoir Blues, and that's a much more upbeat and almost happy kind of set and sort of more rocking kind of, and sort of almost gospel-y kind of feel to a lot of the songs there. But yeah, no, there's always an intensity. There's never a casual performance or song. It's all or nothing with Nick Cave.
Yeah, totally.
Made of stone, so that I would not have to see beauty impossible to define. Beauty impossible to believe. A beauty impossible to endure. The blood imparted in little sips. The smell of you still on my hands as I bring the cup up to my lips.
And I'll say, I think it's so interesting, Stephen, that this is your favorite. Like you said, it's kind of a little different, and it's also kind of a mid-period, kind of a turning point. If you look, you know, at his career overall, he went on to do you know, different stuff and also branch in different directions. And I will say, too, Warren Ellis's violin playing here is really interesting. It's very subtle and definitely points, I think, in some cases. I listened to the record earlier today, to the soundtrack work that they did, which is pretty fascinating stuff, too. So there's a little, you know, you get hints of that in there, which nobody really probably could have foreseen in 97. But it's interesting that there are some of those elements that were developing there.
I fully accept this may not be for everyone. With the previous two albums, I would strongly suggest that anyone should give them a listen, because there's something in there for everyone. If you don't like this style of music, you're not going to, you know, it's not going to work for you. I totally get that. But if you like beautiful, sort of wonderfully constructed and written songs performed amazingly well in a sparse arrangement with a ton of emotion, then fill your boots, you know.
Yeah, there you go. Totally.
All right, you have one more from 1997.
Okay, this is the big one.
Yeah.
Now, again,
after
I
all
imagine
these, this is the big one.
Yeah. So these are all warm ups, right? So including the ones we're not even talked about, I've got a whole list of ones we're not even going to touch on. Just okay. That also came
I
out this
hear
year.
That too.
But we'll get that to the end. But this album, I'm sure everyone will be familiar with this album because this was also massive. This is not only the best album of this year. This is the best album of the 90s, in my opinion. And it's one of the best albums ever made. Mm-hmm. Just take your pick of what you ever think. People say is the greatest album ever made. You know, this has to be in the conversation for the top 10, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about OK Computer by Radiohead.
Yeah.
An album that is so good and moved what they did on so much that they basically had to change their whole career after it because they knew they'd scaled Everest and there was nowhere to go. Mm. You know, when you look at what they did afterwards, some people will try and tell you that Kid A and Amnesiac are better than this. And I mean, they just need to wake up and smell the coffee because they're not. This, you know, this has all the interesting stuff those albums have, but it also has sing-along anthems.
Yes.
So I've been trying to gather my thoughts on this album because I know it so well. I've listened to it so many times.
Yeah.
I love it so much. But when you look at Radiohead, you know, they start off with Creep. It's a massive hit, but Pablo Honey's kind of so-so. You know, then the Bends comes out and it's this massive leap forward, huge leap forward. It's like, oh, this is a really, really good alternative rock record. Mm-hmm. Again, loads of great tunes, big hits, fantastic. And then, okay, where are they going to go next? And then they go, I'll tell you what, that leap we made from 1 to 2, we're going to make that again.
Wow.
From 2 to 3. We're going to go an even bigger leap forward, and we're going to produce this album that basically, in my opinion, is the pinnacle of what can be done with guitar-based rock. And no one's been able to top it since. I mean, when you stop and actually break down what this album is like, I'm guessing both of you guys are very familiar with it because, you like alternative rock, so you can't not be
right.
Very familiar with this
right.
album.
Yeah. It's kind of an essential text. It really is to understand it. Yeah.
But I was listening to it again today, and I thought, hang on a minute. You have to get to track 5 with Let Down before you get to anything that sounds like a normal pop song or rock song. And this is an album, again, that was a number one album. It's a massive, like I say, one of the greatest albums ever made. Yeah, the lead single for this album was Paranoid Android.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, it's
weird.
An amazing song, but when you stop and hang on, it's like this baroque kind of like thrashy acoustic chanting, sort of an alternate version of Bohemian Rhapsody almost.
Right.
Almost as long. And this is what they led off with. And you think, what is happening here? You know, it's just mind-blowing. Other bands must have heard this. I mean, it must have been like when Sgt. Pepper's came out for bands in the 70s.
Totally.
Sgt. Pepper's came out and everyone else went, oh, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
Right. For goodness sake, what are we supposed to do now?
Yeah.
You know, and I imagine other bands heard this and went, well, that's it then, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Should we just go and get a job down the supermarket, you know? Because there's no point.
Yeah.
So, you guys, please tell me your thoughts on it.
Well, I think what you said is really fascinating. I mean, I can remember when I bought this at Best Buy, and it was because the Bish had played me Airbag. And I remember buying the CD at Best Buy and just playing that song over and over. I didn't even get to any other songs before I got home because I loved that one so much.
What an amazing start, the way the bass comes in.
Yeah.
Like, hang on, the bass player and the drum playing different songs, but it works.
Oh my God, it's so beautiful, And then you slowly start to see the lyrics unfold in your ears, you know, and you got to play it again to say, wait a minute, what is he actually saying here? Because, you know, it is kind of sideways, you know, in that way. But I also think, you know, like you were saying, other bands, contemporary bands that heard that, but also how many kids were 13 or 14 and heard this record, either from their, you know, older brother or they got into it or I don't know, and made that the backbone of the band they formed. I mean, you could make an argument, somebody like Car Seat Headrest, even, you know, maybe like this is an album you heard and like this could be the basis of an entire career. It's something you don't really get ever bored with because it's so complex and rich and, and you know, just put together so well.
Oh, totally agree. I would caution, though, bands to take too much influence from this in the sense that you're just not going to be able to do it. So, you know,
no, that's
be careful.
A great point, Jim. And it really is.
I think it probably led a lot of bands down the wrong path in some ways, right?
Could have,
Know your limitations, maybe. But
But
no, it's the thing I always so admired about Radiohead, and I think it manifests itself in this album, was just that they embraced their, for lack of a better word, their experimental side, right? They did not want to be stuck playing any one kind of style of rock music. And I think it was probably the Creep experience maybe that led them down that path, right? That they were like, we don't want to be, you know, sort of conventional rock band like that and have that kind of big hit sing or be known for that, right? And so so the idea that, like, you know, you said, like, I remembered very distinctly, like, hearing, you know, Paranoid Android and being told this was a single and being like, what, you know, exactly like that. And then Karma Police, the other one too, right? So they wanted to put their stamp on that, kind of brand themselves in a different way, I guess, using sort of a, you know, American vernacular. But anyway,
you can't exhaust the superlatives on this album. I don't think, you know, there's certain albums that are just so good. Like you said, you listen to it hundreds of times, thousands of times, listen to it again today, it still sounds great and fresh today. It still sounds futuristic now.
It does.
That's how good.
That's you know, it. Yeah.
The band themselves couldn't top it or match it. No one else has been able to since, you know. And I've always, when I was thinking about this today, I was thinking about, you know, comparing us other albums I was throwing around, like something like Kind of Blue, and that came to mind, like in Miles Davis. You're like, well, okay, Miles Davis created this like epoch defining jazz piece. Basically, he made Kind of Blue, and everyone else who made jazz after that, including Miles Davis, it was always, it might have been great, but it was always less.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, this is the high watermark. This is as good as it gets. And I think, in terms of this being the high watermark of sort of alternative or guitar based rock, I think that's true. But also, in the same way that jazz relates to the blues, in that it takes that format and does something very interesting and much more advanced with it, I think this takes indie rock. This is to indie rock as jazz is to blues. Mm. You know, it's of it, but it's also something else entirely at a much higher plane.
You know, and I think that Miles comparison is very apt, Stephen, because just like you said, Miles had made a couple of big leaps forward, right? Kind of leaving bop and going in his own direction, and suddenly made a massive leap forward in modal jazz when he made Kind of Blue. So, yeah, very, very well said.
There's so many good songs on there. Yeah. It's just take your pick, really. I mean, I've got a real soft spot for Climbing Up the Walls as well.
Oh,
I love
the
dark intensity of it. It's this really kind of like, there's something really quite sinister about that song.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, it rocks really hard as well.
Kind of when you're not really expecting it, it kind of crushes you. Yeah.
Yeah. So whereas some of the other albums might be less familiar to listeners, I'm guessing that fairly most people will be, have at least a passing acquaintance with this album.
For sure.
Yeah. So nonetheless, doesn't diminish its greatness.
This album went double platinum in the US.
Wow. Amazing.
You do get some things right. Then.
Yeah.
Once in a while.
Not many.
So, Yeah. Just an absolute all-time, yeah, one of the greatest albums ever made.
Agreed.
And that on its own would be enough to make 1997 a year for discussion, alone then add in, you know, sort of the three other albums we've talked about, the three others I mentioned at the top.
Yep.
And, I mean, I've got a little list here I've made of other albums that came out that year that we've not even touched on that are also great albums. So you've got Matthew Sweet's Blue Sky on Mars.
Yeah.
Dinosaur Jr.'s Hand It Over.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Earle's El Corazon.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Stereophonics' Word Gets Around.
Oh, wow.
Dig Your Own Hole by the Chemical Brothers, Fat of the Land by the Prodigy. Another really great album is Ladies and Gentlemen, We're Floating in Space by Spiritualized.
Yes, my God, it's one of my favorite albums.
Mogwai's first album, Mogwai on Team. Dylan's Time Out of Mind. The Color and the Shape from the Foo Fighters, Vanishing Point from Primal Scream, Deftones Around the Fur, Smog's Red Apple Falls, Granddaddy's Under the Western Freeway, Portishead's self-titled second album, Pavement's Bright in the Corners, Edith Smith's Either Or, and Supergrass's In It for the Money.
Wow.
So they also came out that year. So that's my case.
Amazing. And I did the same thing, and I'll add to that just a couple of things.
I'm sure there's more.
Yeah. Hanson's Middle of Nowhere. Classic. And $3 Bill by Limp Bizkit. So,
Okay. Well, you've got to put those in the debit column. You've got to put those, that has to be in the debit.
I'm totally kidding, of course. But I'll tell you too, Dig Me Out by Slater Kenny, also 97.
Yes, okay, here. Go on. Yeah. Yep.
And also, one of my very, very favorite records is the Ry Cooder Buena Vista Social Club came out.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that was that year as well.
I love that record so much, man. I've played that one a lot too. And it's just really, really great. The other one I noted was Wu-Tang Forever, the second Wu-Tang Club album, which is amazing. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not really a hip hop or rap guy, so that wouldn't have really been registered on my my radar. But yeah. I'll take others' words.
I'm noticing U2's Pop came out that year, which was kind of a weird record for them, right? And did you mention Perfect From Now On? Built a Spill
that's a great one.
So I think there's enough there, so the prosecution rests, my lord. Yeah, that's my case for 1997 being the greatest year in music, so.
Amazing.
I find the late 90s to be sort of a mystifying time in terms of like where rock was going. Like seemed like the early 90s had some cohesion to it because you had sort of the Nirvana inspired sort of boom in terms of major label alternative rock, and then it seemed like that kind of died out, and the late 90s were this sort of strange time when everybody was trying to kind of figure out what worked and what fit, and music was really starting to fracture, I think, a lot of ways. It was really kind of the beginning of true like indie rock, I think, that really manifested itself in the 2000s. But
I think it's probably also the beginning and end of mainstream rock as well.
Yeah.
In terms of, we talked about OK Computer. That's probably the last of these real big monster
interesting
rock albums that could cross over from the other side, but also from the alternative side and still be mainstream.
And very interesting.
Because of technology and what was coming down the pipe was, naturally, so everything's sort of splintered fractured, and
by 2000, everybody was spending all their time downloading MP3s. As much totally as different. They
you talked once about that book about the 2000s music scene, the New York music scene in the 2000s, and all that kind of stuff, and just sort of like how different it was,
totally
at that time, right? I just find this era of music to be hard to sort of get your arms around. It doesn't define it; doesn't lend itself to definition, I think, the way some other eras do.
Yeah, totally.
It's interesting you say that, Jim, because for me, like I said, this is when I was the most deep into music. Mm-hmm. So for me, this is kind of like, whilst I agree there's no one sort of unifying theme, it's the time period that I've got my head around the most.
Yeah. Interesting.
So I agree that there's not an overarching sort of trend or theme, but it's where I always go back to, A lot of my favorite records came out of this time period,
And it's interesting, too, looking at a lot of these and just clicking around on them. I mean, this was right in the heart of the CD era. Just like I said, if I needed something, I went to Best Buy. That's where I went. There was a Best Buy, like, right down the street, and just all the CDs, and there was very little vinyl made. And, I mean, I was just looking at the vinyl reissue of Boatman's Call. It wasn't until 2014 that they got around to actually putting that on vinyl. So it's so fascinating in many, many ways. Thank you, Stephen, so much. This is great, man. We could do this for two more hours.
Excellent.
No, thank you. It's been great to talk about it.
Excellent. Well, if any listeners want to talk any more about music of 1997, you can call and leave a message. The country code is +1, and then you dial 612-440-1994. There you go. Or you can email rock@suburbspod.com, or you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, all those at Suburbs Pod. And if you'd like to be a patron of the podcast like Steven, you go to patreon.com/suburbspod. All right. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us has been
Stephen Routledge.
And we'll talk to you soon. And we'll, of course, probably hear your new music picks for January coming up soon, right?
I'm working on that already. Okay,
All right.
Awesome. Thanks a lot. We'll talk to you all later.
Thanks, Stephen. Woo-hoo! And we won't even mention the Backstreet Boys. They were huge that year.